listener production.
Hello, happy Friday, and welcome to The Briefing. I'm Katrina Blowers. The lawyers in Donald Trump's New York trial are still trying to decide on jurors. Despite an initial pool of almost 100 prospective jurors, only five had been seated on the case since election began on Tuesday, our time. Many of the prospective jurors have said they just couldn't be impartial. Another two have been excused today, one after expressing doubt about her ability to be fair and impartial, and the other over concerns that some of his answers in court may not have been accurate. Eventually, hopefully, there will be 12 jurors and six alternates. They'll have to decide whether Trump falsified business records to cover up a sex scandal with porn star Stormy Daniels. In an age of social media and increased political polarisation, can juries still deliver justice in high-profile cases?
I've seen more trials abandoned in the last couple of years than probably, say, 20 years ago.
In this episode of The Briefing, we speak to Chief Justice Lucy McCallum about the future of juries. Justice McCallum presided over the trial between Bruce Lehrman and Brittany Higgins, and we all know how that case ended. It ultimately had to be abandoned due to juror misconduct. That interview's coming up, but first, we'll get into today's headlines with Eleanor Harrison-Dengate. It is Friday, the 19th of April.
Good morning, Katrina. We're beginning with an update on the Sydney stabbings. A 16-year-old boy has been charged with committing a terrorist act after allegedly stabbing Bishop Mamari Emmanuel at a church in Western Sydney on Monday. The teenager was detained by worshippers at the Christ the Good Shepherd Church before being arrested by police and taken to a medical facility for treatment. Bishop Emmanuel suffered significant head injuries, and Father Isaac Royal also suffered lacerations and a shoulder wound when he tried to intervene. Yesterday afternoon, the boy was interviewed by police, who then charged him with committing a terrorist act.
Yeah, and Bishop Emmanuel has also released his first message since the attack.
I forgive whoever has done this act, and I say to him, you're my son, I love you, and I will always pray for you.
The Pakistani security guard wounded in the Bondi stabbing attacks will become a permanent resident.
We see no reason why this shouldn't be approved, and I'm very confident it will be approved. He is the sort of character that we want to see continuing to contribute here in Australia.
On a current affair there, Mohammed Taha is recovering in hospital after he was injured while confronting knife-wielding attacker Joel Cauchy. The Prime Minister's already offered citizenship to Damien Guero, a.k.a. Bollard Man, for his heroic efforts to stop Cauchy. Bondi Shopping Centre is reopening its retail stores today after yesterday's day of reflection. It'll be a difficult time for everyone working in that centre in the coming days.
Channel 7's chief executive James Warburton has stepped down from the top job, effective immediately. He's leaving 2 months earlier than expected. It was announced last December he would finish up on or before June 30th. The announcement comes amid two controversies at the network. Former Spotlight producer Taylor Auerbach gave evidence in Bruce Lehrman's defamation case against Network 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson. The federal court heard allegations that Seven Network paid for illicit drugs and sex workers for Lehrman in order to secure an exclusive interview. Seven has said it was appalled by the allegations made and that the network did not reimburse Bruce Lehrman for expenditure that has allegedly been used to pay for illegal drugs and prostitutes and has never done so. And this week, a student who was falsely accused by Channel 7 News as the perpetrator behind the Bondi Junction stabbing will pursue legal actions against the network. Seven has said the mistake was human error and it has been rectified, and that Seven sincerely apologises for the error.
We've got an update on a proposed crackdown for vaping, and vape stores across the country could be forced to close with all state and territory governments supporting world-first federal legislation. Now, these laws would prevent the domestic manufacture, advertisement, supply and commercial possession of non-prescription vapes. State and territory health ministers have issued a special communique saying they are not going to stand by and let history repeat itself, Eleanor.
Yeah, and if it's passed, the only legal way to buy vapes will be through a pharmacy with a prescription from a GP. And the Liberals, Nationals and Greens are yet to declare their position on the legislation.
Yeah, so this interests me because, you know, anyone who knows teenagers, because this is primarily what they're hoping to crack down on, they're estimating that one in six high school students and also one in four young Australians aged between 18 and 24 are vaping. But when it comes to teenagers in high schools, most of them say that they're getting it from their friends. You know, there'll be one kid that, you know, is the go-to kid for buying a vape from. So there's always going to be a way around this, even if the only way you can get them is from a pharmacy with a script. There's always going to be a way. But look, you know, it's great to see them moving on the vaping crackdown. The other argument is, of course, that it is a really effective way for smokers to kick the habit. I think with fewer and fewer people being addicted to smoking now, that argument's got to lose some steam.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all about trying to strike that balance between stopping young people from starting vaping and helping people who have been smoking to come off cigarettes through vaping. And I think that's what the health ministers are trying to achieve. The mystery of the cocaine bricks washing up on our east coast may be solved. Australian Federal Police have charged a Brisbane man with a massive drug trafficking scheme.
We believe this offender was a very serious element of the organised crime network in Queensland and more broadly across Australia.
Detective Superintendent Adrian Telfer there.
The alleged drug lord ran operations in WA, Queensland, New South Wales, and also tried to import 20 tonnes of drugs in the past year, including a 900-kilo shipment that we now know has ended up scattered all over our beaches. He faces a string of charges following a 12-month investigation by the AFP, Australian Border Force, and Queensland Police. I wonder if that means now, Eleanor, that all of those bricks have been accounted for. There have been people eagerly awaiting their arrival on New South Wales beaches. The other thing that got me thinking while I was watching this press conference is they keep referring to this alleged drug lord as being really sophisticated.
This transnational operation.
Yeah. What kind of sophisticated drug lord, firstly, loses 900 kilos of the stuff he's trying to import, and B, the handles that he was using when I'm not sure whether it was encrypted on WhatsApp or what, you know, but it was digital communication. One of the handles he was using was Wanted. Talk about a way to draw attention to yourself.
Yeah, and the other one he used was John Dillinger, who was an infamous US gangster. So really keeping it on the down low there.
Well, we all know back in January, a surf lifesaver at Bondi found one brick estimated to be worth $200,000 while jet skiing off the shore, shared a video of his find on social media. So yeah, as I said, maybe stop looking now, guys. It could all be over. All right, let's get into our deep dive on the jury system. We've had a few high-profile cases now where the whole relevancy of this system has been thrown completely into doubt.
This week, lawyers in New York are trying to pick the 12-person jury for Donald Trump's trial, the first of four he's facing. This trial will decide if the former president is guilty of falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal with porn star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Dozens of jurors had to be instantly dismissed on the opening day after admitting they could not be impartial. After that, prospective jurors have had to go through an initial 42-part questionnaire designed to weed out potential biases before going through another stage of questioning by lawyers. Trial by jury in high-profile cases is fraught, and not just in the US. The criminal trial between Brittany Higgins and Bruce Lerman in 2022 over whether Lerman raped her in Parliament House had to be abandoned over juror misconduct. The jury was dismissed after a juror was found to have been conducting their own research by downloading an academic article that had not been presented in the trial. The ACT Supreme Court Chief Justice Lucy McCallum, who oversaw that trial, joins me now. Justice McCallum, thank you so much for joining us on The Briefing. How do juries generally get selected in a criminal trial?
Well, the first process is that anyone who's on the electoral roll is liable to receive a summons to do jury service. Then there's a process of removing some people who aren't eligible, for example, if they have a criminal record. Then the number of people who are eligible come to court for selection in a particular trial in response to a summons. And then on the day that the trial starts, it's a random process of selection from that randomly selected group. So that the numbers literally get pulled out of a ballot box.
And can lawyers object to any of the jurors that get pulled out of the box?
They can. The number of objections varies from different state to state. In New South Wales, a while ago, they deliberately reduced the number of objections so that lawyers couldn't kind of craft a jury of the profile that they were looking for. I'm in the ACT. We still have 8 objections per accused and 8 for the prosecution. And I did a trial recently where the barrister for the accused objected to every woman whose name came up. So, but that's a random process. That we in objecting to the jurors, the lawyers don't know anything about the juror. They're just doing it basically on appearances.
Interesting. Okay. And so what factors go into a trial being decided by a jury versus, say, a judge?
That is governed by legislation. And it varies from state to state. In some jurisdictions, a person can have a trial by judge alone at their election. In some instances or for some offences, the court has to decide whether the trial should be by judge alone. The default historically was by jury for every criminal trial, and the right to a trial by judge alone is something that's coming incrementally more recently in different jurisdictions. For Commonwealth offences, it always has to be a trial by jury.
So currently in America, there's a trial involving Donald Trump. 50 jurors were immediately dismissed. Is that kind of thing unprecedented, or is that becoming more common, you know, because of social media and especially in the US, increased political polarisation?
Well, it's important for your listeners to understand a significant difference between the process in the States and in Australia. The United States has always had that process of jury selection by a mechanism where the lawyers can question potential jurors about their views, their social media platforms and so on. In Australia, we have deliberately resisted that. The jurors remain anonymous. The lawyers don't know anything about them. They're randomly selected from the electoral roll, and then they're randomly selected from the panel for a particular trial. So that's a significant difference between Australia and America, and I sincerely hope that we hold on to the system we have in Australia where you have deliberate anonymity and not knowing about the people. There is a process for people to come forward with information, so the judge would invite them to say if there's any reason why they think they wouldn't be able to give impartial consideration, but that's based on information that the jurors choose to disclose. And the judge would provide information about the kind of case. I always also give what I call a content warning if it's a case that involves particularly graphic, distressing evidence, which often arises in a murder trial, and in some sexual assault trials, it's more common now for people to film, believe it or not, sexual assault, so the jury has to watch that material. And I give a content warning for anyone who thinks they might find that distressing and not be able to cope with it. So there are some ways in which people can be excused based on information provided to them by the judge and the information they provide in response, but there's no right to interrogate. And I think that's the significant difference between Australia and America.
Personally, I spend, I would say, upwards of 4 hours, maybe 8 hours on my phone a day. I'd be easily accidentally seeing social media if I ended up becoming a juror. How do lawyers actually deal with social media during a trial? How do you sort of instruct jurors not to get prejudiced when they're deciding a case?
It's a significant problem and it's a growing problem. I've been involved in criminal trials professionally for over 35 years, and obviously that began before the advent of the internet. All we can do is direct jurors not to access information about the trial outside the court, but also I'm very careful to explain why that is, and I explain to them that the accused is entitled to a fair trial and the prosecution as well. A fair trial means one where everybody knows what evidence is being considered. If they're getting information from social media, we don't know that they have that information, and that denies the accused and the prosecution an opportunity to interrogate that information and make submissions about it to the jury. I do say to jurors, you know, maybe take a little social media holiday during this trial, but obviously the risk of accidental exposure is high. And again, all you can do is direct the jury. If you do come across some information, please put it out of your mind and explain why it's very important that they decide the case only according to the evidence. They give a promise at the outset of the trial to determine to give a true verdict according to the evidence. And I just keep explaining again and again why that's so important and why it would be unfair if they were having regard to information they heard outside the courtroom without the people in the courtroom knowing that they had that information.
Do you think there have been more abandoned trials because of social media in recent history, or do you think that the, you know, instructions at the moment are solid?
I can only go on my own individual experience and anecdotal evidence, but certainly my sense of it is that I've seen more trials abandoned in the last couple of years than probably, say, 20 years ago.
Could there be a future where we're forced to abandon juries due to the ubiquity of social media, especially somewhere like the US, where there's also this increasing political divide?
I'd hope not to see abandonment of juries. What has been mooted by some academics is the possibility of, instead of directing jurors not to look at anything, embracing the fact that they're going to and directing them to disregard it. And so that's certainly something I can see coming in the future, where you acknowledge that they're going to be reading about the case instead of directing them not to, but explain to them the importance of disregarding anything that they haven't heard in the courtroom and seen tested by the barristers.
And so, for example, say you are a juror and you think that one of your fellow jurors is bringing in outside information, or, you know, information that they shouldn't have. What should you do?
It's so important for the other jurors in that situation to provide that information to the judge. And the way to communicate with the judge under our current system is to write a note, give it to the sheriff's officer or the court officer, and it gets passed on to the judge. But that's the only way the judge can know if someone is not complying with their obligation to remain impartial and only consider the evidence in court. You don't like to make the jurors dibby-dobbers on each other, but jurors are always told, if you do become aware of misconduct on the part of another juror, please tell me. I think people find that hard to do, but it's really important that that information gets passed on to the judge so that the judge knows someone's misbehaving and not remaining impartial.
I've also been seeing that in some European countries there are mixed judiciaries being used, where there's a panel of judges or a combination of judges and lay people. Do you think that something like that could potentially happen in Australia's future?
I think it's a really interesting idea, and I certainly think it could go some way to solving some of the problems that we experience at the moment. Under our system, the matter is tried by a judge and a jury of 12, but the judge and the jurors never speak to each other except in open court. So if the jury passes a note, the judge reads that out in open court and answers it in open court. And all of the judge's directions to the jury are given in open court. If you're looking at a system where the judges could speak to the other lay members of the court behind the scenes, I think that would go a long way to solving some of the problems you've been referring to, of jurors accessing social media or other information and not understanding why they shouldn't have regard to it, because the judge could be there to sort of constantly remind them of the process for impartial determination of the case by reference to the evidence. It could also then lead to problems such as, I suppose, the risks people might say would be the judge might influence the jury too much, or the other way around. But I certainly think it would be worth exploring in the future, because I do think that the current system of directing jurors to disregard material that, as you say, that they're inevitably going to come across has its problems. And we trust the jurors to follow the directions of the judge. That's a legal assumption, but obviously in practice there will be cases in which it's problematic.
And so there's a very good chance someone listening to this may in the future be a juror on a high-profile trial. Can you tell us a bit about how should, I guess, the model juror go about doing that job?
The model juror will listen to the directions of the judge, I think I would say. Understand that the process relies for its integrity on the accused being tried according to the evidence that's given in court. to the extent that you get exposed to different information and different views outside the court, put it out of your mind and understand that the reason for doing that is a matter of fairness to the accused and, as I've said, to the prosecution.
Justice McCallum, thank you so much for joining us on The Briefing.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to today's briefing. That's all for this morning. Before you go, though, we'd love it if you could share this episode with someone you think might enjoy it. And if you want to keep up with our other content, you can check us out on Instagram at The Briefing Podcast and on TikTok and YouTube. Search Listener Newsroom. That's LISTNR. I'm Eleanor Harrison-Dengate. See you next time. Listener.